Session number 11952, Rule 2.
Mr. Rozell, Reel 2. I think you were telling me about how some people overstayed their leave. What would happen to someone who did that?
Well, they would get defaulters, jankers, was the name for it in the army, which meant you had, when you're not on parade, you'd get the defaulter's call on the bugle and you had to report to the guard room. There might be some fatigue or other to do, so you were never free in your free time. In fact, the bugle call went, you can be a defaulter as long as you like, so long as you answer your name. That was the call. And you'd get six days defaulters, say, or something like that. If it was a trivial offence like that, the company officer dealt with it. But if it was more serious, you were put back for the colonel. He dealt with it. I saw the colonel twice, but that was in France.
What happened to you then when you went down to Shorncliffe? What did you do?
Well, we did ordinary parades. We did a lot of manoeuvring. Imaginary attacks, and we stayed out all night sometimes on night manoeuvres, as they called it, and we very often fought with another brigade. That was all arranged, where they were advancing on the town and we were repelling them, or vice versa, and so on. Those sort of manoeuvres. We also went to the firing ranges, and we did a duty, they called it a dutyman's course, where you did grouping, so that would teach you whether your rifle was throwing left or right, because you aimed at the bottom, and if your group was to the right or left, you knew. But then we had ordinary scoring from 100 yards, I think it was in the beginning, and then 200 yards. I think we went up to 300 yards, and we practiced 15 rounds rapid fire. That was the dutyman's course. And
how many rounds would you fire at each range, do you think?
I suppose about 10, something like that. And then we did our duty also as markers. We would mark in the butts for some other regiment, you know.
When you were learning to shoot, were you taught individually or were you taught in groups?
No, we were taught more or less individually right in the very early days, as I told you, with a tripod, but practicing pulling the trigger, or squeezing it, really. Taking the first pull off and then squeeze it gently so you don't pull the rifle off. And so we had it between manoeuvring, drill. We would find the colonel or somebody would find a flat field where the whole battalion could, and they'd have NCOs, even down to a lance corporal, drilling the battalion, making them in company line, and so on and so forth. And we were always pretty busy, I remember. And
could you remember when you were actually issued with your own rifle?
No, we were issued with our own rifle some time after when we got to Aldershot.
But not at Shorncliffe?
No, not at Shorncliffe. We had these rifles, but they were only for the range. In between, we had wooden rifles.
For the arms drill?
For the drill, yes.
When you were doing the tactical manoeuvres, you said you would go out and you would practice attacks and so forth. Where were you doing that? Were you on an exercise ground, or were you over
No, anywhere round about, because I remember all round at that area, towards Folkestone, and I forget the names of villages now, but it was quite pleasant, and of course it was getting on for the autumn, but it was still very pleasant that first year, 1914, and I loved it in the country, having been a town boy. And we also began to get more leave, not a lot of leave, but a weekend perhaps every 4 weeks, something like that.
On the manoeuvres, did you have blank ammunition?
Later we did, but not in the early days. Later, I think that would be when we were at Aldershot.
But at Shorncliffe you were just manoeuvring without...
Yes, without all that.
Did you actually carry a rifle or a wooden rifle on a manoeuvre like that?
Yes, in the early days.
When you were doing an attack, what sort of formation would you adopt on a manoeuvre?
Well, we might be... It depends. If you were on outpost duty, say, there'd be a small group of you guarding as far as you could see your position. And you had runners who could... If you saw somebody, you sent a runner back to headquarters that the enemy were approaching in numbers and things like that. We also practiced sending messages back. When you were on parade, that was, say, a yard apart. And it's remarkable how, at the end of a company, sending a verbal message, how it was altered with the time. You know, you've probably heard of the story of where send reinforce. Oh, I'm going to attack. No, I'm going to advance, send reinforcements. And it apparently ended up at the other end. I'm going to advance, send reinforcements. That sort of thing. But it was true, you know. People add a little bit or take a little bit away as it goes down. But we were taught to do that accurately, because there could be times when that was the only means of communication.
But if you were doing an outpost duty, how would you actually select a position for yourself?
Well, we'd probably have it selected for us. We'd be told to go that headland, say, and there'd be another group somewhere else and so on, surveying the whole of a slight valley or whatever it was. So it was surveyed for us, you see. And they also had staff people who were umpires, who would tell us at the end of the day how we'd fared, whether we'd been overrun or we'd made this mistake or that mistake and so on.
When you were actually attacking on a manoeuvre, what sort of formation would you have for that?
Well, we had to... first of all, we would advance in artillery formation. That is, you could march, but there were gaps between each section. Then we would get extended order, one single line. And then we'd have section advances where you blew the whistle and you advanced the double, say, 20 yards and dropped, and somebody else to do the same. That was under, well, supposed to be under rifle fire when you were advancing in sections. Pity we didn't do it when we got to France.
So this was all over open ground then?
Yes. Yeah.
And could I get the artillery formation a bit straighter? You said you'd march with gaps between you. Would that be gaps between...
One platoon and another, so that if a shell dropped, it wouldn't take the whole...
So you'd be advancing still in column of four, would
yes,
you?
Yes.
But with intervals between the...
That's right. That's how we
platoons.
Had it, yes.
Did you ever practice moving in a diamond-shaped formation?
No, I never came across that.
What about Arrowhead? Do you remember doing that at all?
No.
So it was either then column or interline for... An attack under rifle.
Yes.
Did you ever do a technique called pepper potting, where you worked in pairs rather than going by sections?
No. When we were in France, we had small patrols that went out, perhaps only a couple of you, and further along there'd be another two and so on. But I don't remember any name to it. It was just a patrol of two or three, you see.
Now you say that sometimes you did manoeuvres at night. Mm. How did the way you worked at night differ from the ways you worked in daytime?
Well, we usually marched to some point which was supposed to be either our front line or our defensive position, and we'd post sentries, and the remainder would be supposed to be resting or sleeping, you see, and change the sentries every 2 hours or 4 hours, according to how we were instructed. And also, when we received word that the enemy were approaching or something like that, we'd man the whole our perimeter.
The whole firing line.
Yes.
Did you get taught map reading at this stage?
Yes. But I was taught map reading later, because I became a sniper. And we always did map reading, and because when there was no sniping in the line, one of our useful duties was to, if somebody was being worried by a trench mortar or continuously firing, they would send for a sniper, and we'd send a map reference back through the signalers to the artillery, and they would just concentrate on it, or the mortar. People would drop mortars on it. Those sort of things we did. So that's why we wanted map reading. But that came later when we were in France.
Did they give you much instruction on camouflage while you were?
No, not really. We were told about camouflage and why it was done and to blend with the surroundings and so on. But actually, it was never any practical use, except, as I say, when I was a sniper in France, we camouflage our loopholes, of course. But even then, they knocked them down.
So really, at Shorncliffe, you were doing the basic mechanics of fire and movement and manoeuvring in the field. Mm-hmm. Did you ever do any digging in?
Yes, but later on, we did quite a lot of it, and it was practical too, because we dug trenches along the cliff tops at Folkestone. And we did that at night also, and we were taught to put barbed wire entanglements out at night, because you were using mallets and pickaxes for the trenches, and you've got to be able to do it in the dark without injuring your comrades. So we did that very often at night.
Did you do any practice in attacking trenches?
Well, only just attacking, you know, when they advance and charge and so on, fixed bayonets and charge.
Was that at Folkestone, or did you start doing that earlier?
No, we did that. Yes, we did that at Folkestone, yes, because we were also instructed in making jam tin bombs. And we threw an odd one at just, not everybody, but later on everybody threw a Mills bomb. But in those early days, we hadn't got bombers as bombers, but we knew how to construct although I never knew how we would get hold of gun cotton and things like that, which they had to show us how it was done, you see. But how we could have obtained it, I don't know.
How did you make a jam tin bomb?
Well, you fill it with gun cotton, you put a detonator in, and you had a fuse, and you had to strike a match, strike the matchbox across the match, and get the fuse going and throw it. And that was that. And we put stones or anything like that you could get around the gun
cotton. Mm-hmm. How far do you think you could lob a bomb like that?
Well, I've got no idea, but you could lob it further than you could a Mills bomb, because you couldn't lob a Mills bomb. We had to bowl it. If you tried to throw it, you just about dislocate your arm, because I think they weighed 2 pounds, I'm not sure. You had to do that like a bowling at cricket. Well, I think about 30, perhaps 30 yards, I'm not sure. A little more than a cricket pitch, I suppose.
You mentioned the fixing of bayonets before rushing the trench. Mm-hmm. Was there a great emphasis on bayonet training?
Well, we did quite a lot of charging and stabbing straw sacks, you know, and that sort of thing. And we were also taught bayonet fighting.
What did that consist of?
Parry. We never did it with an opponent, I might tell you. Parry, button, what they call it, button, foot and butt, I think. You made a step forward and swung him back to his chin, you see. That was your button, back, parry again, and then lunge, and back. And they told us, because this was a bit of a sort of theory, really, that don't forget, when you stick it in the German, he falls down, so don't leave go of your rifle. And to get it out, you turn it, pull it out. Of course.
It all sounds very bloodthirsty.
It does, doesn't it? Yes.
Did you have any feelings about the Germans at this time?
Not really. We had the things that we'd been taught more or less over the years at school, because we always heard about Der Tag that was coming. And then we were taught that they were our enemies, and then we were taught that one Englishman was worth six Germans, and so on, until we met them, of course. But I had no feeling. I always felt sorry for them. And so did... I've noticed our fellows swearing about them, calling them this, that and the other. And then if you captured it, and they came along the line, they were giving them cigarettes or water or anything, you see. And I remember we pulled one over the top. We heard them moaning and groaning, and after an attack, and we went over the top, and there was a huge German. We lifted him back. He was very badly wounded. And everybody's the same, you know, poor devil, you know. And every now and again he wanted Wasser. And of course we were short of water. That was another thing in France. People don't often realise we're always short of water, because an army up the front, the few pumps, the farmers took the handles off the pumps, because in a day you'd run him dry, a regiment. So all our water had to come from somewhere in our water cars, so it was rationed, you see. But as I say, our chaps would give the Germans water if they were asking for it. There wasn't a lot of bloodthirstiness. There might have been in the heat. I mean, when it's kill or be killed, that's different. But since I was a sniper, I tell you, and I never shot anybody in cold blood. I just couldn't do it. But when somebody else had been sniped, one of your pals, the next one you saw, that was different.
I was paying back a debt.
Yes. And when we were surrounded, when I was captured, that was different too, because they were shooting off people down like rabbits. And where I was, the main body of our people were running down there, scattering. The Germans were here, about 30 yards from me, standing up on top, bowling them down. Well, I was here, and you may depend, they were enfiladed. So there you are. And that was kill or be killed. That's different.
But did you ever find anybody in, you know, when you were in England training, who had any really strong feelings of hostility to the Germans?
No, I don't think so. They used to say they're German bastards and all this in their conversation, but nothing else.
So why had they actually joined up? Was it just for excitement, or...?
Well, a lot, yes. I know it was with me. I thought it was an adventure. And I think most of them did too. And on top of that, of course, they were calling you to fight the Germans, king and country and whatnot. And that was it. But I soon found it was not much of an adventure.
When you finished at Folkestone, where did you go after that?
Before we went to Folkestone, we went to... The mud at Shawncliffe under canvas was 2 or 3 inches deep. This is when the winter began to come on. So they shifted us to and began to smell. We'd been told not to throw morsels of food about and that sort of thing, you know, because of it would smell in the mud, but I suppose people were throwing bits away, and because our rations were served, we sat on our beds in the tent to eat, you know. And I suppose they threw bacon rind and things like that away. Anyway, it was awful, the smell of the mud. So we were shifted to huts at Sandling, that's very near Hythe, a few miles away. And we stayed there until the first Christmas, and we were moved into civilian billets in Folkestone. And from Folkestone we marched to Aldershot. That's when our old soldier, the regular soldier ones, were threatening us then. Oh, your nursery days are over. You're going to where they make you into soldiers now. Aldershot, they've been there, you see. But we didn't bother about it much that I remember, you know.
How long did it take you to march up to Aldershot?
We marched to Ashford one day. I suppose about 4 days. I think Ashford was the first in some museum, and I remember we went to Red Hill, I think, and Dorking. We were put up for the night in civilian. That wasn't in a museum or a school. We probably made about 4 days of it. Hmm.
Did you find it difficult to keep up, or were you quite happy?
No, quite happy. And by that time, of course, we had our full packs and rifles and everything else. Water bottle and bayonet and haversack. Pouches, no ammunition, of course. And that was part of our training, I suppose.
Did you spend every night in under hard cover, or were you out at all on this march?
Well, on manoeuvres, some of those manoeuvres we did night-to-night duty, you know, just occasionally. But Aldershot we did quite a lot, because later on at Aldershot, it was a spring coming, because we left from Aldershot to go to France at the end of May, 15. And by that time it was a beautiful spring, and around Aldershot there's all pine and heather, and we were manoeuvring all around there and stayed out at night sometimes. The same sort of manoeuvres we'd had before, but they were more umpires, and it was more a stricter sort of battle orders and so on.
What sort of scale of manoeuvres were you working up to then? Can you remember doing anything?
Yeah, we'd go out for about 3 days, a couple of nights out, and marching and retiring and whatever we were told to do. But about 3 days, we were quite exhausted when we got back. It was really tough training, you know.
And do you know how many troops would be involved in one of these 3-day manoeuvres?
Well, probably a brigade, because they were talking. By that time, they'd formed the battalion, the brigade and the division. Because we had I remember it was 36 Brigade, 12th Division. And I can't remember the generals in charge. I remember one brigadier, he was our brigadier, Barraclough. But I don't remember any of the others.
Did you see much of the brigadier?
Pardon?
Did you see much of the brigadier?
Not really. If we had a general's parade, you see them, inspection and so on. Sometimes it was the divisional general. We saw Kitchener once. And the King once, and Princess... Who was the Princess?
Princess Mary.
Yes, yes. She was on the side of the road. Yes. Yes, because she stumbled and fell over, you know. And the fellows in the back room at night were making crude jokes about it, what they'd seen, you know.
All sounds like it was rather cheerful.
Yes.
Did you carry on doing shooting while you were at Aldershot? Did you go
yes,
on the
we,
ranges?
We used to go to Ash Ranges. I remember Ash, still there, I believe. Ash Ranges, and that's when I became a sniper, because we did another duty's course, and before I joined the army, except for an air rifle or something, I'd never fired, but I took to it. I loved fire shooting. And when we went through the Duman's Corps, there were marksmen, first class shots, second class shots. Now all the marksmen, they made into, there couldn't be many of them, because they made them into 25 snipers. I was one of the snipers. I was a corporal by then. And I was the corporal and we had a sniping officer. And it was nice because we were always, we didn't pray to a battalion normally. We prayed on our own. When we got to France, we prayed it on our own, out of the trenches. So we did map reading and things like that. And in France, if we could find a gravel pit or anything with a bank, because we had telescopic rifles, and the Germans, they had, it must have been an issue, they all seemed to have the same sort of nickel watch, and they were often given to you. If we had those, we would stick them up on the bank, you know, and make souvenirs of them. And when we were in the estaminets, the non-combatants, like the Army Corps and so on, they'd buy them off us, you know. We'd never say what they were. We'd say, look at that. Cool, a lucky devil. Who had that? You know, one of my friends or something. I'd like that as a souvenir. So we got beer money from it, you see.
So were you then attached to battalion headquarters as a sniper?
Yes, yes. Headquarter company, they called it. There were the signallers, which were the telephone people. Snipers, bombers and orderlies.
You didn't feel tempted to do signals training then?
No.
Electrical background?
No. No, well, I didn't associate it with it, really. When signallers, I assumed they'd be semaphore. Well, they did train in that, the signallers, you know. In fact, we all did, just to get the alphabet. And I never associated it with anything, but of course, they were using telephones, ground.
Did you go away to be trained as a sniper, or did that just happen in the battalion?
No, just happened. All the marksmen, they made us snipers because we come out on top of the firing exam, you know, the journeyman's course, as they called it, duty-man's course.
Did they train you on any sort of special range with moving targets or anything?
No, nothing like that. We just had the fixed targets. And for the 15 rounds, we had the silhouette of a man. The other courses were the ordinary target.
The round target.
Yes.
When you were trained for sniping, what sort of ranges were you taught to shoot at?
Well, you were told that I'll go back a bit. We had great difficulty, I always found, in finding any place that we could use as a sniper, because the Germans had usually got the position that they retired to when we came up. We had one place in Hooplines where the trenches ran through a village, the houses, and we were able to, in the houses, we were able to get several places where we could snipe from. But if we got a really good observation post, we had to keep it as an observation post. We're not allowed to fire from it, you see. So our sniping was very, very few and far between, the opportunities. And this idea that you go out and make a place in no man's land and you snipe from there, well, it doesn't work. It's not practical. You can't see anything lying down on your tummy, really. We used to spend our time putting loopholes, you know, the steel loopholes. We'd perhaps work all night, the snipers putting it in a place where we thought we could get a good fire view, and camouflage it as best we could and so on. But usually they must have looked at our parapet with binoculars and so on. The least thing different was suspicious, you see, because we very seldom kept one of those. It was usually mortared the next day. All our work for nothing, you know. But we did get one or two, and I remember one. That was at Hooplines too, where we could look into just a small part of the communicating trench that ran at right angles to ours. so you could see while they walked these few yards. But once you used that, it was finished. Because for one thing, they'd block it so that people couldn't go round there, dig another trench or something, and or we'd be exposed, and of course they'd bomb it or get the artillery on your spot. So I've read a lot about the successful German snipers, but as a sniper, I don't think we were very successful at all. And as I told you, I never shot anybody in cold blood. I remember one place we had, and I saw a German put his head over the top, red hair sticking up, bulging eyes, probably about my age, and he was looking round. Must have been the first sight over the top, I think. And he got down. He got up again. Well, I was thinking of my duty, and I said to myself, if you come up again, I'll have to take you. He came up again, but I let him go. And later on, when we were, well, this was at Arras, later on, years later on, as we were going over the top, they brought a German to me that they'd picked up,